Okay, thank you very much for the introduction. Okay, I have to switch this thing. Yeah, welcome to my talk. Iris Illustrative Rendering of Integral Surfaces. Before I start, I want to show you two examples of integral surfaces rendered with our system. So on the left hand, you can see a stream surface from flow around an ellipsoid rendered with silhouettes, our transparency system, and two-sided shading. And on the right, you can see a path surface from a rising plume of hot air rendered with a striped texture, also using our approach. So first about integral surfaces. They are known as common tools for flow visualization, and they are made up from particles that traverse the flow and form a surface together. And there are several variants, like stream surfaces, path surfaces, streak, and time surfaces. And I'm just going to talk about one example here, just to show you. This is a video of a streak surface of the same plume of rising hot air, also rendered with our system. And the surface is constructed by seeding particles forming a line, a circular line, in the bottom of the image, or in the bottom of the video here, and advancing this line through the flow field, and then you get a surface. And the surface itself is also transported by the flow. So there are several computation methods for these integral surfaces, and most of them produce triangle or quad meshes. So the surface is represented as a triangle or quad mesh, and we are going to use such a mesh as input. And in recent years, there have been both offline computation methods for big data sets and interactive methods for smaller data sets. And for both kinds, we would like to have an interactive visualization of the surface. So for the offline computation methods, it would be nice if we were able to see the progress of the computation. And for the interactive computation methods, of course, we need an interactive visualization. So if we try to visualize these integral surfaces, we run into a few problems. So the problems are similar to the problems from the previous talk. We have much occlusion going on. So just as an example, I cut open the surface for you, so in the picture here. And there are inner tubes or inner features you couldn't see if you just look at the surface from outside. So also, if you just look at the surface by itself, you do not have very much information about the flow itself. So there's the direction of the flow is missing. And now you have basically two ways to go at this. So you could cut it, open the surface and look at parts of the surface. And Sylvia Bond, who's going to do the next talk, did a great job doing that. But we are taking a different approach. We are trying to visualize the surface as a whole. So this is where our system comes in. Iris is basically a set of tools for rendering these surfaces. And we use some selected illustrative methods to deal with these properties of integral surfaces. And if you look at illustrative rendering, you notice that there's a huge body of work already present. And to keep this a little more manageable, we just restrict ourselves to three basic techniques. So we use transparency to address the occlusion problems. We use silhouettes to enhance the perception of shape. And we use texture to hint at the shape and convey the direction of the flow. Before I go into these techniques in detail, I will just show you how we can implement this. So as an input, of course, we have a quad or triangle mesh with texture coordinates. And I'm going to talk about these texture coordinates later. And we process the layers of the surface independently using depth peeling. So for each layer of the surface, we go through the geometry path once. And then we can do something with it, like apply our techniques to it, and blend the current result behind the previous results. And just to give you an idea about depth peeling, if you're not familiar with it, it's an order-independent transparent rendering technique that's been around for a few years. And here's just one example object that we are going to render. So the layers look like this. The first layer would be what the viewer would see in an opaque depiction, and then we render the remaining layers subsequently. And each of these steps would be one pass of the pipeline. So if we use transparency, well, of course, that is, if we just use a constant value for the opacity, the results don't look very good. So this is an example. The surface itself looks very faint because we have to make the surface very transparent to be able to look through these many layers. So here you can see just a few details from the surface. And you can't see very much. So instead of using a constant value, we use values based on the viewpoint and the shape of the surface. And this is what we tried first. So we modify the transparency based on the angle between the direction of the view and the surface normal. So if you look at the surface and you have areas that are perpendicular to the view direction, they will appear entirely transparent, while surface areas that are aligned with the view direction will appear entirely opaque. So the opacity increases as the surface is curved away from the viewer. And you can also see this here in the image. And now, all of a sudden, these inner features become visible. But we still run into another problem. So if we just tilt the view from this example a little bit, this is the same surface, same settings, just a different view direction. It doesn't look so good anymore, because again, we have occlusion problems, or the same problems we had with the constant opacity, because areas that are in front of the viewer get lower transparency values because they are tilted. So instead of using the view direction, we have a different approach. We call it normal variation. So we take the normalized normal of the surface in view coordinates, and we look at the variation of the z-component in image space. And here I have the small example picture. In this top area, which has relatively high curvature, you can see that the normals vary strongly. So the z-component variation is also quite high. And this area would become pretty much opaque. While in this lower area of lower curvature, the normals are quite close to each other, or they are very similar, and the z components are also quite similar, so the opacity wouldn't be so high here. In the end, it can be said that smaller features, areas of higher curvature like creases, will appear more opaque. And this is what it looks like. So you can see that areas which are smoother, like the context regions outside are more transparent, even though you can still see these small waves. Well, you can also see the tubes inside of the surface. I introduced a parameter gamma here, if you looked at the formula in the previous slide, which you can use to control the strength of this effect. So based on which kind of surface you have, you might want to adapt that. So how does this perform in comparison with the angle-based transparency? In the bottom right, you can see our normal variation approach applied to the same tilted view as I did before for the angle-based transparency. And you can see that the tilting problem is not an issue anymore. So the outer region that occluded the view before is now quite transparent. So I talked about the pipeline before. So where do we put the transparency into the pipeline? Well, after we rendered each layer, we can just compute the opacity values based on the properties of the surface and modify the alpha channel of this layer, and then use the opacity value, or the alpha value, to blend this additional layer behind the previous result. So the next technique is silhouettes. They are commonly used in illustrative rendering, and you see them in almost any illustrative depiction, because they are very useful to enhance the perception of shape, so because you can see outlines even if the opacity is not very high. And so we also implemented this. And in the pipeline, this is straightforward, exactly as before with the transparency. For each layer, we can detect the silhouettes using an image space edge detection algorithm, or like the Sobel filter, to detect these silhouettes and modify the opacity and color values. Then we have this small feature, the window transparency. If you want to look at the surface, basically from the outside, and you want to focus on a certain area, the user can select this area, which will then be rendered with our transparency approach. So next, texture. Well, texture is often used to enhance the perception of shape. Like, there are techniques around, like hatching. But here with the integrated surfaces, we have to be a little bit careful about that, because these methods often introduce some kind of directional information. There are some lines, and that might be confused with the flow direction. So we already have some kind of directional information present in our surfaces, which we can then use to apply texture to the surface. This is not so easy. In this example, you can see that the texture coordinates are often strongly stretched with factors often exceeding 1,000, and these stretching factors are often anisotropic. So if the surface is stretched in one direction, it is often compressed in the other. I talked about this natural parameterization. I think I didn't. Okay. So we have a natural parameterization on the surface, which comes from the computation of the surface. For our stream, path, and streak surfaces, we have two parameters, S and T, where the S is the position on the initial curve, and T is the integration time. And for time surfaces, we just have a parameterization of the initial surface. And of course, we can use this parameterization for texturing. So to deal with the stretching, we have this adaptive pattern approach, which is similar to the mip-mapping used in graphics hardware. But so different layers, levels of the texture are used, and based on the image space variation of the texture coordinates. So here in the middle, I have a minimal example of that. This trapezoid surface is stretched. So on the left hand, it's twice the size as on the right hand. And for each point on the surface, the texture is determined by interpolating between two adjacent texture levels, where one level is twice the size of the other. And you can see on the right the result of applying this texturing approach to the plume of hot air, to the path surface of that data set. So in the pipeline, this fits in the same spot as the transparency and the other methods. When we have each layer, we can compute the levels based on the image space derivatives of the texture coordinates and sample the texture, modify the color and the opacity of the surface. So, about performance. Well, the performance strongly depends on the depth complexity of the surface, on the polygon count, of course, and on the viewpoint, because that determines how many layers are in the surface from the point of the viewer. So for smaller surfaces, which we will usually have when we use an interactive computation approach, we have also basically interactive frame rates exceeding 15 frames per second for surfaces with less than 500,000 triangles. So here are some more examples. This is again the stream surface of the ellipsoid data set. On the top right, we just have the normal variation transparency as before. On the bottom right, we have also normal variation transparency, but we also have silhouettes, and the surface, the one side of the surface is colored in a different color than the other side. So if you look at the outer region, the flat regions, in this area, the surface is colored in a more orange tone. And as the surface turns around, the backside is colored in a more bluish tone. And in the left image, you can see that our texturing approach can be used to create lick-like depictions of the surface. So the texture that is applied to the surface is just a texture of noise, which is blurred in one direction. And our approach can put this onto the surface with hardly any effort. Notice that we didn't use the luminance of the shading to hint at the depth here, but different colors. This is another example from the plume of rising hot air. And on the left, you can see constant opacity values applied to the surface. And you see that, well, there isn't very much to see, actually, because it's hard to distinguish these layers anymore. And on the right, we use normal variation transparency, and the image becomes much clearer. This is a stream surface of flow around a car. And I split this in half because it's fairly symmetric. So on the top, you can see the normal variation transparency applied to the surface. And these fairly flat regions around the car become quite transparent, while the regions about the side around the side view mirror stay opaque. So or they are opaque depending on their on the fineness. So it's easier to focus on these regions here, and you can still see the model in the background better. To show you how our system deals with animations and also with changes in the view, here's a video of stripes applied to the ellipsoid surface. And if you look closely, you notice that the texture is refined as the view was zoomed in onto the surface. And this is an animation of a procedural pattern of stripes onto the, put onto the surface to hint at the direction of the flow. So the orientation in addition to the direction. Then here we have a stream surface of a vortex core breakdown bubble. In the top image, you can see the normal constant opacity value applied. And in the bottom image, you see our normal variation approach. So in the top image, it's very difficult to make out anything. And you can't even see the shape of the tube that comes in from the left anymore. It's just the same color all over. While our normal variation approach preserves the shape of this area while still allowing the user to look into, or the viewer to look into the surface and distinguish the layers in there. So this is a really complicated surface, and we can still see somehow what's going on. And finally, here is a video of the same surface, and you can see it as it's being built up by showing the integration front of from the computation here. You can see how these layers inside are formed. Okay, I think I was a little bit too fast, but this is it. I'll be happy to answer your questions now.
Yes, plenty of time for questions. Please state your name and affiliation.
My name is Peter. I wanted to ask, is this approach implemented for the polygonal data?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the last few words.
If this approach, for which kind of data is this approach implemented? For the polygonal?
Yes, for the polygonal representation of the surface.
Ah, okay, because to my mind it would be very interesting if it is adaptable to the volume data, because the same issues about visibility like arises there.
Okay. So for volume for the volume data, of course, you would need a different way of rendering this the data set. But basically, approaches like the transparency measure, you could apply this to volume rendering by looking at the direction of the gradient. Of course, this is an example, and it's been done before, I think. Mm-hmm. And well, the texturing, you would need some kind of parametrization that is available. So if you have an integration time and some kind of second parameter for from the initial curve, you could of course also apply the texturing to that.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Stefan Bruckner, Vienna University of Technology. I was wondering, maybe I didn't quite get that. So for your texture mapping approach, you said it was kind of related to MIP mapping. And as I understand it, I didn't quite get the difference to MIP mapping, actually.
Okay, for MIP mapping, what you usually do is you have a finite set of textures where each set is basically a downscaled version of the same texture. So as the variation of texture coordinates changes in image space, you choose an appropriate level so you don't run into performance issues and you have a smoother view of, or you don't have aliasing problems and stuff like that. So in our case, we did it a little differently. So first of all, we don't have a finite set of textures, but we just changed the sampling of the texture. So each next level is sampled at twice the size. And we don't use a downscaled version, but instead we tile the textures to each other. So that as the texture coordinates vary in image space, we choose an appropriate level based on so that the resolution of the texture in image space stays technically the same, or more or less the same. So we have the same stripes, even if the texture coordinates would be much stretched in other area.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? In that case, let's thank the speaker again.